We all deserve some yay in our day. So say hello to Hello. Hello makes oral and personal care products that add wonder to your routine, like a toothpaste that makes brushing fun for kids. It's called Unicorn Sparkle Toothpaste. It tastes like rainbows and sunshine, works brilliantly, and it's fun. So it's pretty much magic. And for the adults, Hello Anti-Plaque and Whitening Toothpaste, which is just as good without the unicorns. Visit HelloProducts.com and let Hello add some everyday yay into your life.
This is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
Speaking with Professor Sean McMeekin of Bard College, the author of the new book, Stalin's War, A New History of World War II. From the point of view of Joseph Stalin, who inherits from Vladimir Lenin, the thinking, the theory, set the imperialist capitalist states against each other. Do not enter the war until the end and gobble up territory. Recover the Russian Empire and more. Create the power of the earth by watching the monster nations of France and Germany, those in England, those were the three that Stalin had in mind, batter each other just as they did in the Great War. The U.S., of course, was a new consideration for Stalin. And now comes a mystery that Sean presents to us in his book. I said the Battle of Moscow turns on a couple of details, the frozen ground, followed by the muddy ground, the exhausted German invasion, the exhausted Russian defenders. However, 6 months earlier, a man named Harry Hopkins, representing the President of the United States, lands in what Sean gives us the detail, an American Douglas transport craft. After a four-hour flight, he lands at Moscow. Sean, what is the mission to Moscow for Harry Hopkins? Who is he, and what does he accomplish?
Well, I think the purpose of Hopkins' trip to Moscow was to establish a very direct channel of communication between Roosevelt and Stalin, to some extent, to try to find out what the odds of survival were, except that Hopkins, I think, was already convinced that Russia would survive. In fact, he already saw the U.S. military attaché, Colonel Ivan Yeaton, as kind of an enemy because Yeaton had some doubts about Russia's warfighting capacity. The main purpose is just to arm Stalin, to arm the Russians, ostensibly in order to, of course, counterbalance Hitler's armies and in the long run make it so that the United States would presumably have an easier time of it if and when the U.S. entered the war. The U.S. at the time, of course, was still neutral. But effectively, he establishes this very personal relationship with Stalin, at one point even meeting him without interpreters or even any aides present. And to Stalin's surprise, really, and almost to his shock, he just basically says, we're going to give you whatever you want with no conditions applied. You know, Yeaton, who wanted to apply certain conditions regarding his terms of access to information and maybe even observe how the stuff might be used at the front. This is all denied. Yeaton is sacked. Hopkins actually appoints a man to replace him, Colonel Raymond Faymanville, who actually is an NKVD asset who regularly meets with the Soviet secret police. And Stalin basically says what he needs. I mean, there are all kinds of things that he needs. Aluminum is actually probably number one on that list, although anti-aircraft guns and artillery and small arms ammunition. There are a lot of other things that he needs as well. In the end, he needs just about everything. I mean, foodstuffs, boots for uniforms. They need Jeeps, Studebakers. Not all of it is determined in this July meeting, but the basic of the relationship is already established, which is a very one-side thing. The U.S. will give Stalin whatever he wants and demand nothing in return. Among other things that I think we were just talking about with Japan, he does not ask the Soviets for any help against Japan in exchange for almost single-handedly fueling and funding and arming a vast percentage of Stalin's ability to fight for war over the next 4 years.
The politics of this. FDR, as Sean has indicated, was disposed towards aiding Stalin's fight against Hitler. However, there are voices, very powerful voices in the Congress in the United States, who believe that in any attempt to aid Stalin is the same as aiding the devil. We come to a quote from the very powerful Hiram Johnson of California. Scoundrels, Hitler and Stalin, he goes on to say. Hamilton Fish of New York says that no American mother should have to suffer aiding Stalin or in any fashion supporting Stalin. Harry Truman himself says, well, we'll back the one that seems to be winning, Hitler or Stalin. In other words, they're regarded as the same kind of beasts. And the quote from La Follette, FDR is trying to whitewash the monsters in Moscow. These are atheists from the point of view of the United States in 1941. They do not have all the facts of what Stalin's NKVD has done in the Baltic states or in Poland or in Finland. But they're correct in assuming it was monstrous. We know Sean lays out the facts. They're too gory to reproduce of what Stalin's been up to. He is a monster. To debate Hitler or Stalin, who is worse, is foolish. The opinion is both of them to be gone. Sean, the mystery is, what is FDR's opinion that he overcomes these sensible voices in his own party?
Well, just a brief correction. Truman actually said we should aid whichever side was losing or weaker, not the side that was winning.
All right, fine.
I think the idea was, effectively to help them fight it out. But yeah, why did Roosevelt view things so differently? This is a little bit of a mystery. I mean, there's probably this angle of kind of noblesse oblige, almost seeing the Soviets as this plucky underdog. It was something of a fashionable opinion, particularly among many of America's kind of, you might say, well-born and well-connected. Not that they were all Soviet sympathizers, but you got more of that than you did in, say, the Midwest, or in a lot of the rural areas of the country where people were, I think, equally wary of both dictators or seeing them as equally as evil as guilty. Roosevelt sides very, very firmly with Stalin. I mean, there's nothing ambiguous about this at all. Back in March, when they were debating the Lend-Lease Act, there had actually been a congressman from Massachusetts, Tinkham, and also a Senator Reynolds from North Carolina, I believe, who proposed amendments to try to exclude the Soviet Union from Lend-Lease aid. Those were defeated, mostly because the Democrats controlled Congress. So even if some of them, they had such a firm majority, even if some Democrats voted against, they still had enough votes to defeat the amendments. And so Roosevelt had effectively already won the political battle. They had determined effectively it was all up to his discretion, this kind of good faith clause. He could make the determination himself. But he was, of course, no political naive, so he knew he could just announce it out loud. And so, in fact, they keep this basically secret for the first 6 months. They even conduct their own opinion polls. So Hopkins has the Gallup poll. They did a public one where 54% of the U.S. public was opposed to aiding the Soviet Union against Hitler. Their own polls show that they have majority support in only 11 out of the 48 states, not including any of the key ones involved in Lend-Lease production or shipment, not Michigan, not California, not New York. There's no clear majority. So they know that they have to keep this secret, and that's why they do, really, until November. I suppose the drama of the kind of the revolution parade and Stalin staying in Moscow and making it seem like the Soviets probably would survive. This is what leads, I think, Roosevelt to kind of come out in the open and admit what he's been doing all along with $1 billion credit line, doubled to $2 billion. And, you know, by the end of the war, it's more than $11 billion. Effectively, no questions asked, no terms applied, no quid pro quos demanded. But it's definitely a controversial policy, which is why they kept it so hidden from the public for so long.
The puzzle, in addition, includes Churchill. Churchill is not fooled by Stalin's conduct. He's not a politician who spends a lot of time being consistent. He'll change if he must, and he finds a way to present Stalin to the British public as acceptable. However, he also participates in Lend-Lease by letting equipment that he needs, either in Singapore or at home, he lets that equipment go on to Stalin. One interpretation, the one I like, although it's so cynical, is that they were hiring the Russian army as cannon fodder. Does that hold up to the facts, Sean?
I think that's definitely part of it. I mean, Churchill had at times almost an excess of imagination. That is to say, he was so imaginative that he would have these almost kind of flights of inspiration or fancy. So that after Barbarossa, after the Germans invade the Soviet Union, you know, he says, look, I know that the Soviets have committed all these crimes, but I'm just going to forget about it because I'm so overwhelmed with sympathy. And among other things, as you point out, this famous shipment of the 200 Hawker Hurricane fighters, the workhorse of the RAF during the Battle of Britain, that are supposed to defend Singapore, and instead he sends him to Stalin, along with hundreds more warplanes that fall, and the Batilde and the Valentine tanks, and aluminum, which actually retards Britain's own aircraft industry. I mean, Britain is actually forced really to kind of hold things in for a couple of years as far as her own commitments, even her own domestic manufacturing, because so much is reconsigned or sent to Stalin. And yes, I mean, even some of the equipment which was supposed to defend Egypt, we're talking about kind of the battle in North Africa. A lot of those tanks are actually sent to Stalin instead by way of Iran. Now, as far as the purpose of this, again, I think some of this is, as Churchill had already made clear, that he saw the Soviets as a bulwark against Hitler, even when they were partnered with Hitler. He had talked about this as early as 1939 and 1940. He was actually somewhat notorious for this. So he definitely had this idea. I think some of it was also his historical imagination. He remembered that Russia was on Britain's side in the First World War. So he still had this notion of the brotherhood in arms, no matter how obnoxious Stalin might have been in his regime, no matter how many crimes they might have committed. There was still this notion that there was a kind of a natural relationship, brotherhood in arms, or as you put it more cynically or hard-nosedly, perhaps he simply saw the Russians as kind of cannon fodder. And there's an argument that has been made. Is that this basically allows Britain to avoid really fighting the Germans directly for most of the period between 1940 and 1944, except for in North Africa and over the skies and eventually in Italy beginning in July 1943. It's true. The Russians were doing most of the fighting. And that gave them almost this kind of moral blackmail argument. You know, the Americans are sending us spam, but we're the ones bleeding and suffering and dying. And you'll hear Russians say this today. So the Russians definitely support that interpretation of Lend-Lease.
The book is Stalin's War. Sean McMeekin is the author, A New History of World War II. Sean mentions North Africa. We'll go there for the Darlan deal. The Darlan deal becomes a problem for FDR, and the solution is unconditional surrender. I'm John Basham. CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Professor Sean McMeekin. His new book is Stalin's War, A New History of World War II. Stalin setting the imperialist states against each other, tear each other up, and now gobble up territory. Except Stalin was out of equipment, weapons, food, in order to continue the fight. So he came to depend almost like a child on the arsenal of democracy. The arsenal of democracy run by FDR and the American people. However, we come to troubles, especially early 1942-43, in which FDR and Churchill make a deal, although it was Eisenhower who did it, with the French commander of the North African forces, a man who switches side, goes from being a fascist sympathizer to an American sympathizer. His name was Darlan. It's an obscure detail of history, but it did bother FDR, I learned from the professor, a lot. So we come to January 1943, the Casablanca Conference in North Africa. Stalin does not attend. Churchill's there. Roosevelt's there. Sean, why does FDR announce unconditional surrender?
Well, it's a great question, John. And the Darlan deal and the kind of almost political stench surrounding it definitely had something to do with this, in part because Roosevelt was used to the kind of the conservative Southern Democrats and the Republicans attacking him for various things from the quote-unquote right. But he's getting it from the left now, too. They're all saying he's sort of soft, that he's cut some deal with this fascist Vichy regime, that he's soft. And this is a little bit of an obsession for Roosevelt because, of course, it plays in with his own complex that really the U.S. is not doing enough to really fight the Germans. I mean, after all, it was a little strange to begin with that he had declared Germany first as the priority. This back in Arcadia, December 41, after Pearl Harbor. And then on top of that, they declared the number one priority inside of Germany first was aid to Russia's offensive by all available means. And he's done everything he can to please Stalin. They've sent him just about everything that they could. At the time of Stalingrad, they're giving Stalin first priority for P-39 era Cobras. Roosevelt was even offering to send U.S. pilots to help Stalin in the areas over the North Caucasus and Stalingrad. But Stalin's position was unwavering. You know, he wants planes, but not pilots. He does not want any U.S. or British pilots to actually participate over the Soviet skies. And so Roosevelt, he can't make Stalin happy. No matter what he does, Stalin keeps complaining about the lack of a second front, that the U.S. and Britain are kind of waging war at most in these peripheral theaters. The Russians are doing all the fighting. And so FDR is just desperate to kind of show Stalin that he's serious. And his initial idea is actually to send Marshall to Moscow with this kind of almost like diplomatic surprise gift, telling Stalin, well, look, we can't give you a second front yet, but instead we'll give you a consolation prize, unconditional surrender. But Stalin, he's not having any of it. He says, purpose of Marshall's mission not clear to me. No, I have no interest. So then Roosevelt announces unconditional surrender at Casablanca, and yet again it falls flat with Stalin, who's just not impressed, who keeps needling him about the second front, over and over again. Becomes this just unquenchable leitmotif of Soviet bellyaching that the United States and Britain haven't opened a second front. Even when they land troops in Sicily and then the Italian mainland in July 43, he's still complaining that there's no second front. Well, of course, it never occurs to anyone to ask why Stalin is collaborating so closely with Imperial Japan in Asia. There's no second front against Japan. But unfortunately, as Roosevelt tries to please him, and he just can't make any headway.
Yes, we come now to not only Roosevelt being sensitive to Stalin's needling, and not only Roosevelt worrying about the politics of making deals with devils. The concern here is a separate peace, that Stalin will make peace with Germany, or England will make peace with Berlin. Everybody doubts everybody else, moving story. And yet we come to a fact that weighs on everything at the time. February, March, April 1943, the discovery of the Katyn massacre, the Katyn forest, layer upon layer of bones. Who are they? They are executed Polish officers. Who did it? Stalin and Molotov. That's who did it. And Sean, we just have a moment here to spend time with this. The Poles know who did it. Sikorsky's government knows who did it. They tell the truth. And not for the first time, not for the last time. Popular opinion, global opinion, all the historians, all the newspapers go along with what they know is probably falsehood. That itself is striking to me. Was Stalin surprised that Churchill and Roosevelt went along with the lie that it was the Nazis who did it and not the Soviets?
I'm not sure if he was surprised. I mean, after all, for 2 years, they had really bent and buckled to every one of his demands regarding Lend-Lease, regarding Allied priorities. Of course, save the Second Front, which was the great complaint. But in every kind of diplomatic and political sense, they had gone along with Stalin. And so he bullied them quite firmly and unambiguously into it. He didn't just deny responsibility for the crime. He, of course, accused the Nazis of it. The Soviets would go so far at Nuremberg. They actually tried to pin the crime on the Germans, knowing perfectly well that, of course, they themselves were responsible. But it's not just this question of responsibility for a crime. Stalin uses this to break off relations with the Polish exile government in London, which ends up having serious political consequences. It's the first step in his ability to isolate, maneuver, and then in the end kind of destroy any possible representation for the more moderate, patriotic, right-wing, any type of alternative to the communists in terms of Poland's political future. So he actually uses this as a lever, not just to sort of force Roosevelt and Churchill into endorsing the lie, but also to put forward his own claims on Poland, his own claims to rule Poland's political future.
And in that lie, there are other lies packed inside. One revelation to me is that there were entreaties from Canaris. This is German intelligence pointing to the fact that there are people in Germany who want to get rid of Hitler and make a separate peace. Stalin knows this. In fact, he's appealed to Hitler on and off over the years for a separate peace. FDR turns away from this. Why? What did FDR doubt about the separate peace?
Well, there were certainly back-channel negotiations of all kinds, really, from the earliest days of the war. But you're right that although Stalin, one doesn't know how serious he was about the peace parleys vis-a-vis Hitler, whether you're talking about 1941 or 1943. When it comes to Roosevelt, there's a clear moment in 1943 where the Germans appear to be pretty serious. There's even this attempted bombing of Hitler where they nearly kill him in his plane, but the detonator doesn't activate. And there are all kinds of back-channel approaches to U.S. intelligence figures, to U.S. diplomats in places like Switzerland and Spain and Turkey and Istanbul. Roosevelt rules this all out emphatically,
right.
In part because I think he wants to uphold this unconditional surrender idea. In fact, he makes a firm decision that the U.S. press must not even talk about the German resistance because that's going to kind of muddy the political water.
The book is Stalin's War, Sean McMeekin. When we come back, The Second Front. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Sean McMeekin is the author of the new book, Stalin's War. He's a professor at Bard College. Stalin has needled, hectored, used the rhetoric of Second Front for years. Well, here it comes, 1944. We know it as D-Day. However, there are many details inside this before D-Day actually happens. It's important to explore them all. and it has to do with the lend-lease. First protocol, second protocol, third protocol. It's not just the dollar figure, which is enormous. It's the ability of the Soviets to plunder the United States. Whole Ford factories, suitcases of what we call intellectual property. At that time, they would have called them blueprints. Being guarded by NKVD men with submachine guns as they're transferred unopened boxes to the Soviet Union. Sean, I had the image while I'm reading your very careful and shocking explication of not just 70,000 tons of sugar in the first protocol, but those boxes of plans in the third protocol extended. I had this image that all of this equipment, all of these blueprints, all of the technology, all of the pieces of the Ford plant went to some warehouse in the Soviet Union and was never touched. Just a winter outside. Stalin was doing it because this is the highwayman from the Tiflis massacre. Grab as much as you can and think about it afterwards. So did Hopkins know this was happening? Did FDR know this was happening? Did Stettinius, a friend of Hopkins, who will later become the Secretary of State for Truman, for heaven's sakes, but did Stettinius know that they were plundering American technology?
Well, Hopkins certainly knew. I don't think Stettinius knew everything, in part because I don't think Hopkins always revealed everything to him. And I also don't think Roosevelt probably knew the full extent of the story. But Hopkins absolutely did. I mean, there's evidence of Hopkins personally intervening to make sure that this one famous shipment of special chemicals effectively enriched to processed uranium make its way to the Soviet Union. I think Hopkins definitely knew what he was about. He was quite open about it in public. He didn't necessarily give all the details, but he would say, for example, that because the Soviets were going to be so powerful after the war, we should give them whatever they want and desire. He was quite open about that as a policy, even if he didn't reveal all of the details publicly. But yes, as far as you relating this to D-Day, you're right. I mean, what would be the purpose of these vast shipments of intellectual property, of entire factories, pneumatic chain hoists, entire lines, really, of aircraft and tanks being designed to Stalin's specifications, the Boston bomber, the Douglas A-20 Havoc bomber, the P-39 Era Cobra, the diesel Sherman tanks? What would be the purpose of all this being designed, built, and sent to Stalin, if not to aid the army somehow? And they did kind of sort of remember to ask at Tehran, even as Roosevelt was lining up alongside Stalin against Churchill, really, vis-a-vis the kind of priorities that they're ruling out any further operations in the Mediterranean, all the landing craft can be devoted to D-Day. They did remember to ask that Stalin wage a simultaneous offensive in Eastern Europe to draw off strength from D-Day. Well, there was a Soviet offensive earlier that year, a much more kind of subsidiary offensive. The actual offensive, named after Bagration, the commander from the Napoleonic Wars, was actually delayed so that it was not launched until more than 2 weeks after D-Day, so that the Germans were able to transfer troops from the Eastern Front to Normandy and Western Europe. And of course, from Stalin's purpose, that was all to the good and entirely justified. Finally, the Allies were going to bleed and die a little bit. But of course, this opens the field for the Soviet armies, who are now riding on American rubber. And they've got the American Studebakers and Jeeps and tanks and trucks, along with the warplanes and their own equipment, a lot of it manufactured with American steel and aluminum and with American fuel and petroleum. And all of this is now rolling in this massive mechanized army that's going to pour its way from Belarus eventually into Poland. And eventually, amazingly, in Poland, Stalin actually re-gifts some of his equipment to his Polish communist puppets to go around hunting down Polish army fighters and American Studebakers and even Harley-Davidson motorcycles. It is a pretty amazing story. And the part about Stalin delaying Bagration, I don't think most people have probably paid much attention to this, in part because there are probably genuine reasons you could delay a military operation. What's more interesting, though, is that Churchill and Roosevelt forgot to ask him about it. And in fact, they just stopped mentioning it in their correspondence after about early April 1944. Admittedly, they're preoccupied with D-Day and all kinds of other problems, and so maybe they just kind of forgot. But they didn't mention it again, and Stalin was quite pleased they didn't call him out on it.
Harry Dexter White at Treasury is identified as an NKVD agent. There are other names to mention. You've mentioned the colonel who takes over in Moscow as an NKVD agent. there is a suggestion over the years that Harry Hopkins may not have been everything we think of him, a devoted servant to FDR. Have you seen anything that you regard credible that Harry Hopkins was an NKVD agent?
I haven't seen anything conclusive, no. I've certainly seen the kind of the rumors and some of the evidence bandied about. But with a lot of these things, you know, if there isn't really enough to make, you know, a firm sort of an opinion. My own hunch or inclination is that in Hopkins' case, it was far more a matter of him being a volunteer. That is to say, just a kind of what we might call an agent of influence, which isn't, he wasn't necessarily regularly reporting to anyone on the Soviet side. He just saw himself as fully devoted to their cause for various reasons. And in the end, I think people like Hopkins were actually more important to furthering Soviet interests than most of the paid agents were, important though they might have been. In the case of Harry Dexter White, I think he was almost certainly important because he was so high up in the Treasury. Alger Hiss, of course, is another name that comes up, and he did have some influence, and he's there at Yalta. You can see him there in the proceedings, and he makes these kind of subtle interventions. But I think in the case of Hopkins, he was probably the most important Soviet asset of all, but he was not an asset in the sense of being on the payroll or reporting regularly to Soviet intelligence. He simply had developed a personal relationship with Stalin, and for various reasons, I think, saw Stalin's interests as increasingly his own, and was simply devoted to serving them. You know, in a way, really only at one degree removed from the way Roosevelt had come to see Stalin, although Roosevelt kind of had a moment towards the end where he began to doubt some of the wisdom of putting so much of his trust and faith in Stalin. I think Hopkins remained loyal even longer than Roosevelt did.
There were other voices. Avril Harriman to Moscow, ambassador. He challenged Lend-Lease, especially, I believe, the third protocol, maybe the second as well. Third protocol went on continued after the war. Was Avril Harriman credible to FDR? Did he have doubts when Harriman challenged what was being transferred? Because Hopkins, whoever challenged Hopkins, he would say, it's legal, I have the power, and that would be the end of the conversation.
Well, that's right. No, Harriman, for a time in 1944, did actually try to exert some type of leverage to try to say that the United States should at least have some say in what the Russians were doing with the equipment that we were sending. And some of it they weren't even using. We're sending these marine diesel engines. We would have been much better off using a D-Day, and the Russians weren't even using them. That was one of the cases they used, that the U.S. should have exerted at least a little bit of leverage. But in this case, yeah, Hopkins simply overruled him. And in the end, I suppose Roosevelt simply sided with Hopkins. I mean, among other things, Hopkins had a huge advantage of proximity. He was literally sleeping in the Lincoln bedroom for almost 4 years during the war. So he's the first person Roosevelt sees and often the last person he sees before he goes to bed. So Hopkins simply had that type of influence that no matter how connected a person like Harriman might have been, by the time he's in the Moscow embassy, you know, he simply doesn't really have the power. I mean, you mentioned Thamenville. I mean, Thamenville was supposedly a U.S. Army officer, but his appointment was not made by the Army. It was made by Hopkins. He reported directly and personally to Hopkins, and Hopkins simply arranged things this way so that he could really outmaneuver and outfox anyone who was trying to really throw any wrench into the works of this rather peculiarly one-sided relationship between the U.S. government and Stalin.
We've gone very fast here, and so we'll turn in the epilogue to pull together some other instances where Stalin gets his way because he is obliged by men as powerful as Winston Churchill. This is Stalin's War. Sean McMeekin is the author. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. My conversation with Sean McMeekin, professor at Bard College, author of the new book, Stalin's War. This is a tour of the familiar territory, 1939 to 1948, from the point of view of Moscow. There are, however, puzzles. One of the puzzles we've bypassed, but I want to come back because it's not all on FDR telling himself this will work out. It's also Winston Churchill. Sean, who are the Chetniks? Who is Mikhailovich? What does Churchill make of the presentation he's given by the BBC and other Czechist agents in London that he should side with the wrong people in Yugoslavia?
Well, I do think Churchill at times during the war would put up at least a little bit more fight than Roosevelt did on some questions of strategy, but not in Yugoslavia. I mean, this is definitely a good one to single out where I think Churchill really was hoodwinked. Now, I mean, to be fair to Churchill, there was some evidence, and some of it was uncovered by British intelligence, the so-called Enigma decrypts, that Mihailovich, who was this officer in the former Yugoslav army, who was the legatee of the Yugoslav government in exile in London, who led the Chetniks, this kind of group of rebels who took to the hills and tried to resist the Nazis after the Germans invaded Yugoslavia in April 1941. Now, Mihailovich, like his kind of counterpart on the left, Broz or Tito, who was, of course, answering to Stalin, at times during the war would have to negotiate various kind of deals with either the Italian occupying authorities or even once or twice with Serbs or indirectly with the Germans. There were sometimes prisoner exchanges, weapons, and you could very easily weaponize this information politically in order to smear someone as a collaborator. And that becomes the official communist line on Mihailovich, is that he's a collaborator. It's a grotesque slander, of course. I mean, his Chetniks resisted the Germans long before the partisans of Tito did, because they had to have Soviet permission. Until the Germans invaded the Soviet Union, the partisans were not even resisting. Nor, of course, did they do as much damage. The Chetniks were much more effective, man for man, pound for pound. And in fact, in September 1943, there's this extraordinary moment where the Chetniks engage the Germans directly. They actually inflict serious casualties. They blow up some bridges. And the BBC and all these other media organs actually give credit to the partisans for the things the Chetniks actually did. And then there's this agent, Fitzroy McLean. We don't really have time to explain exactly who he was, but he was someone who Churchill trusted and sent to Yugoslavia. And he just goes to Tito. He never meets with the Chetniks. He just listens to whatever Tito tells him, and he feeds this back to Churchill. And Churchill, probably just wanting to believe it, he had told McLean he basically wanted a positive report on the partisans. He got it, and so they decided to cut off the Chetniks. And amazingly, they don't just cut off the Chetniks. By the end of the war, they're really endorsing the slander against the Chetniks, you know, who in the end are subject to effectively kind of Soviet-style show trials and executed, in large part because of his communist talking points that the British government adopted as their own.
Asia, another story, and yet, because it's pressing on us here in the 21st century, in October of 1945, there's a moment when Stalin might not get what he wants because Mao and Chiang are talking about agreeing with each other, which is quite fantastic, of course. But the U.S. weighs in by saying, we will not arm Chiang Kai-shek, if he's going to use our weapons to fight a civil war with Mao. Stalin, on the other hand, not only arms Mao, he takes the Japanese army's arsenal and arms Mao. The Washington opinion at this point is a puzzle to me. Remember, FDR is gone. Truman is in charge, but Truman did not have all of the range of information. There's Stettinius, there's Harry Hopkins, there are other voices, but George Marshall is sent to China to sort this out. Sean, it appears sometimes as if Stalin has a devil on his shoulder who's in charge of people's good intentions. What is Marshall's mission when he goes to China, and how does it favor Stalin?
Well, Marshall's mission effectively is to first apply very strict conditions, as you were implying, on any aid, military aid to Chiang Kai-shek, and then eventually to cut him off, as the United States does in 1946. I mean, with really extraordinary timing. We're all told about the kind of the chronology of the opening of the Cold War and the Truman Doctrine being announced and launched in February 1947. Well, the Truman Doctrine didn't apply to China. The United States had cut off China in 1946. And some of this went back to the war years and China being really kind of cut out of lend-lease aid in any substantial way as early as 1943, 1944. Some of this went back to these earlier decisions. The only one you didn't mention, but which I just have to emphasize, is that the U.S. had, of course, also armed Stalin's Far Eastern armies. They had sent 8.244 million tons of war material, including about a million tons of motor fuel and aviation gasoline to Stalin's Far Eastern armies, effectively free of charge. So that Truman's own policy is a little bit of a contradiction. There's a moment right before Stalin enters the war where, because Truman really doesn't allow Stalin to join the Potsdam Declaration, the kind of almost ultimatum to Japan before the atomic bombs are dropped, Stalin, of course, is still neutral at the time. So it made sense for the U.S. to exclude. And there's a little bit of an angle in which it seems like the U.S. at least briefly was hoping to get the war with Japan over without the Soviets intervening. However, that intention, if that was Truman's intention, was undermined by the fact that the U.S. had spent most of the last 4 years, and particularly the last 12 to 14 months, arming Stalin's Far Eastern armies and giving them both invitation and permission and encouragement to invade Manchuria, Sakhalin, the Kurile Islands, and even Korea. So it's a really kind of extraordinary story that just gets stranger the closer you look at it. And then as far as what Marshall was up to, again, as to why the U.S. reversed course and cut off their own ally in China. It's not the only time this has happened, of course. The U.S. did something similar with Batista in Cuba in 59, with Goh Jin Jem in Vietnam in 1963. It's a bit of a mystery. And some of it obviously must have to do with the policy advisors who were advising Truman, the climate of opinion shaped really by a lot of influential journalists, some of whom had communists on their staff who were all kind of constantly smearing Chiang Kai-shek and Madame Chiang for their corruption, that they would waste the money and that the U.S. Would not allow this. But there are these other strange parallels with Yugoslavia, which we were just talking about, where the British kept accusing Mihailovic of not fighting the Germans. He just wanted to have a civil war with Tito. Well, of course, there's a civil war. The other side realizes it. Just for some reason, the U.S. decided to cut off its own side in the Chinese civil war.
So what we have then, FDR and Truman, permitting Stalin to dominate the two parts of China that are most worthwhile, Manchuria and northern China, Manchukuo, the Japanese called it, and plunder it. We know he plundered Berlin. We know he plundered Germany, everything he could get a hold of. It's this compulsion to steal, the bandit. But he plundered China as well. Did he believe in Mao? Or was this using Mao to make war, I don't know, on Korea? Was he setting Mao up in the same fashion? Because there are anecdotes about him disdaining Mao when Mao was ordered to Moscow. We have a couple of minutes. We can explore this, given where we are in the 21st century, Sean.
Sure. Well, I don't think Stalin ever fully trusted anyone else, whether you're talking about Bierut and his Polish puppets, or Tito in Yugoslavia, or Mao in China. However, I do think Stalin was willing to use these people effectively, that is, to promote Soviet influence abroad. In the case of whether it was Poland or China, he wanted what he would call, in the term of art, a friendly regime on his borders. And meanwhile, yes, he would exploit the war to seize as much booty as possible. Of course, they had a euphemism for that, too. It was called nationalization. But yes, the richest parts of Manchuria are all mass looted by the Red Army to the tune of some estimates as much as $2 billion at the time, which, of course, today you probably have to go up into hundreds of billions, if not $1 trillion worth of kind of equivalent. And they do the same thing, of course, in Germany, all these other occupied countries. They take, as they call it, reparations in kind, some of it in terms of slave labor, people they would send to the camp, some of it in terms of property. All this scene effectively is in part reparations for war damages, but also, of course, just as the just deserts of communism. They're nationalizing all this property on behalf of the proletariat. That's how I think Stalin sees it. So, no, I don't think he fully trusted Mao. On the other hand, he was perfectly willing to arm and to use Mao in order to further his interests.
And what we have then at the end is some very hard questions you ask about Lend-Lease. Let's focus on that. This transfer of technology and food, feeding the Red Army, feeding the Russian people, at the deprivation of the American people and the American war front in some instances, created the conditions, I think your case is, created the conditions for the Soviet Union to emerge as a superpower, arm itself with nuclear weapons it probably stole the plans of, and create the conditions in the second half of the 20th century that you and I grew up on that have beggared the earth to this day. Is that Lend-Lease? Is that where we go, Sean?
Well, Lend-Lease is a big part of it. I mean, to get back to the questions of kind of victory and defeat, you know, Stalin's plan in Europe was nearly upended by Hitler's invasion. And as we talked about, of course, things, you know, nearly came a cropper in October to November 1941, where the regime nearly collapsed. A large part of what allowed them to go from having withdrawn really the boundaries of communism to kind of just central Russia between Moscow and the Ural Mountains, and then eventually expand out all the way to Berlin and Beijing. Right. It wasn't all Lend-Lease, but Lend-Lease played a humongous role in this, especially in restoring the mobility to the armies, and particularly in Asia, which is almost always ignored. You can't imagine this empire in Asia being created without those 8.244 million tons of Lend-Lease.
The Lend-Lease that gets me, Sean, is the butter and the sugar. That's the Lend-Lease, the butter and the sugar.
Yeah, Americans are told to eat margarine because the Russians need the butter.
Sean McMeekin, the book is Stalin's War, A New History of World War II. I'm John Batch.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
What if every student had a tutor and personalized learning was available to everyone? What if every family had a financial guide and their investments made for an optimistic future? What if every doctor could diagnose you in seconds and healthcare visits felt more personal? What if your business never slept? And every customer's shopping experience felt like it was designed especially for them? It can with Agentforce, the powerful AI from Salesforce.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code iHeart or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
This message comes from Greenlight. Ready to start talking to your kids about financial literacy? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app that teaches kids and teens how to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest with your guardrails in place. With Greenlight, you can send money to kids quickly, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on what your kids are spending with real-time notifications. Join millions of parents and kids building healthy financial habits together on Greenlight. Get started risk-free at greenlight.com/iHeart.